We left off at the end of Jeremiah, I believe. We're on Lamentations, continuing our biblical theology, mostly to make Noel happy, because it's not systematic theology. Lamentations, we're continuing the story. So Lamentations was written in reaction to the devastation of Jerusalem. It expresses the psychological and spiritual anguish over God's abandonment of his people and his hostility toward them. You know the historical setting behind it. The Judean king Jehoiakim rebelled against Babylon's oversight of them and joined forces with Egypt, and Nebuchadnezzar came in 588 BC and set up a siege against the city. Now, you know what a siege is? So Jerusalem was a walled city, so they couldn't get in, but they set up a siege around it. And for 18 months, they maintained this siege around there. So there was no going in and out. And so what happens in the city over that period of time? Yeah, resources begin to run very low. And so there's no water, there's no food. And the conditions deteriorate to the point of cannibalism. Yeah, that actually mothers take their young children and kill them and boil them for food to live on. Yeah, I was teaching this to your wives on Monday. I said, yeah, this...
They're ahead of us.
They're in a different... Yeah, they are ahead of you, yeah.
That's why.
They're better learners than you are. Yeah. No, I have less material to teach them, yeah. Yeah, so what a cheery way to start Monday, ladies. Let's talk about boiling your children and eating them for food. Lamentations is a... It's a, hi, guys, glad you could just... casually stroll in. It's okay. I don't feel any dishonor or lack of love. Lamentations, I just read it the other day just before I taught that class, just to go back and reread it. And it's really written as a funeral dirge. It's a funeral song that goes into the depths of emotions. The classic work on personal suffering is Job. But the classic work on corporate suffering is Lamentations. So Lamentations is when a nation experiences sorrow and tragedy. In the original Hebrew, the work is anonymous. The Septuagint adds to it and says it's the words of Jeremiah. Ryan, are you getting this? Now, this is important. It's going to be on the test for you. It adds the words. It's written by Jeremiah, but that's as an addition to the original Hebrew text. And so the weight of evidence for Jeremiah's authorship or against his authorship is pretty even. It's pretty even, 50-50. So it's better just to accept the anonymous nature of the work. Possibly written by Jeremiah, not sure, but it's written anonymously. Someone who certainly experienced the siege in Jerusalem. Lamentations was written in a rigid, poetic form called acrostic. Acrostic. Are you familiar with that, acrostic? Do you know what acrostic is? So you take the letters of the alphabet, and that each line starts with a different letter. So in the Hebrew alphabet, there's 22 letters. So 22 lines. Each verse in chapter 1, 2, and 4 correspond to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. In chapter 3, each letter of the alphabet has three consecutive verses. And then in chapter 5, it's also a 22-verse poem, but not an acrostic. So there's been a lot of questions about why the author went to such great lengths to write this in this format. Because if you're going to limit yourself to a very strict poetic form, it's very demanding. If you've ever written, for example, iambic pentameter, or any kind of traditional Western poetry that has a very clear meter and a rhyme scheme, every line is laborious to get it exactly to fit exactly how you want it. So to write this in this manner poses all kinds of questions. Why would you, in the midst of this kind of sorrow and suffering, take the time to put this into this kind of literary format? And while we have no definite answers, some of the answers that are proposed are that, number one, it's a memory device to make it easier to memorize. Like maybe you might, a teacher with her kindergarten class or her young class might teach them something using the alphabet. A is for the apple, B is for banana, right? It becomes a mnemonic device for memory. Another approach, and I think I like this better, it's more like it would be like the A to Z of suffering. The use of the alphabet symbolizes the completeness. This is as great as suffering can get. There's no part of suffering left out. It's A to Z. The whole gamut is covered here in this experience in that Lamentations accounts. Another thing that if we were reading in the Hebrew, which we're not, the author uses not only the acrostic device, but he uses what's called a limping meter. The second part of the verse has one less beat than the first part. So that produces a droning dirge, like funeral chant kind of effect. So when you read it in the original language, the method of reading and the meter enforces the subject matter of the sorrow and the darkness and the pain that they're experiencing. Some of the intercanonical themes that we experience here is grace and law. Lamentations is an existential plunge into the depth of despair that disobedience to God will cause. It screams out the horrific consequences of sin. And yet in the midst of the most sorrowful and pessimistic book in the entire Bible, these great words of comfort ring out. This I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindness indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Great artists know if they want to get a dramatic effect in their painting, they use a process called juxtaposition. Juxtaposition is when you take color opposites. Do you remember your color wheel? Did you learn that in grade school, the color wheel, right? So there are color opposites. We call them complementary colors. They're on the opposite end of the spectrum. Any of you remember?
Yes.
So like on the opposite end of the spectrum from yellow is?
Purple.
Yeah. So if you put yellow and purple together, it's very vibrant, right? Some of you Laker fans probably know that, right? The opposite of blue on the colors is orange. Yeah, right. So Vincent van Gogh was especially noted for that. If you've probably never seen any of his paintings live, you've maybe just seen copies, but when you see the actual painting, it's almost like the painting is a light source. It's so bright. Because he would take big globs of blue and right next to it the orange, and it's that contrast that makes it so effective. I think this is what's happening here in the book of Lamentations, is this verse, which is really the only good news in the book, for the most part. And it's interesting, it's right at the middle part. It's about in the middle of the middle chapter. So it's like you go up and then down, but it's the high point. Everything else is bad news. But it's almost like in juxtaposition next to the pain, the judgment, the darkness, the gloom, and yet what shines out? The Lord's loving kindness never fails. And so I think, when we preach this verse, the context of it makes it even more powerful. You know, to make a statement like that when you're experiencing that kind of pain and sorrow and suffering is a pretty strong point. Habakkuk is next. Habakkuk and redemption history. A couple interesting things about Habakkuk before we start and look at his role in redemption history is one of the reasons he's unique among the prophets is he doesn't speak for God, but he speaks to God about his people. Really, what Habakkuk is a look into the prayer life of a prophet. And I thought this would be an interesting way to teach Habakkuk. I know we did a series, was it 2 years ago?
Yes.
On Habakkuk. Was it three? Yeah. When God doesn't make sense. But I thought another way to approach it is when we want to do a series on prayer. It'd be good to examine Habakkuk's prayer life, because the whole book really is prayer. It's dialogue. It's him talking to God. It's God answering. So you could do a real nice series, I think, a unique series on prayer, just looking at the prayer life of Habakkuk. And that's an interesting way to study the book, to read it, is to read it from the viewpoint of prayer life and, Lord, what can I learn about my devotional life and how my prayer life can be enhanced through Habakkuk. Habakkuk was written at a time when God was raising up the Babylonians. Assyria had begun a rapid decline around 625 BC, about the time when Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, became king of Babylon. So probably written around 625, 605. So we put it, it's in the same time Jeremiah's writing, Jeremiah, certainly, probably it's before Ezekiel and Daniel, but in that time frame. So in the beginning of Habakkuk's life, the nation would probably be at a high point. Josiah is the king. There's a revival sweeping. Josiah's reforms are beginning to affect the nation. But by the end of his life, Josiah would be dead, and destruction and despair is coming. Habakkuk's prophecy is concerned with two questions. Habakkuk's first question is, why doesn't God do something to stop the sin that is rampant in the nation? So that's his beginning. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? You know, that would be that's a great way to do your prayer series, you know. So why is it that you don't seem to be getting answers? I mean, that's certainly a reality, right, from a lot of people. Or cry out to you violence, but you do not save. Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. Lord, why are so many people taking bribes? The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. A side note for your consideration. It's noticeable how often spiritual deterioration is connected with violence. See, twice in this verse, we have the word violence. That's the main issue. There's a spiritual deterioration, and it results in violence. It's a common theme in the prophets. In my lifetime, I've watched, especially in American movies, the theme of violence escalate to such dramatic proportions as our nation spirals downward morally, as there's more and more spiritual deterioration, and that's just a reality. Violence has a much more prominent place. Even in the shift, in my lifetime, the shift is gone. It used to be when I was a kid, baseball was everything. Football was a minor concern. The Super Bowl wasn't even telecast. I think it was a tape delay, the first Super Bowl. What an amazing transformation. See, baseball is a slower, more of a gentleman's game. I mean, occasionally there's some fights, you know, but for the most part, it's a thinking man's game. You go to the ballpark, the game lasts 3.5 hours. There's lots of time for fellowship. So when you're at a baseball game, it's a communal activity. You know, you're talking, you're fellowship. Oh, then something interesting happens, you know, and then you're talking. Football just nonstop smash mouth, hit them in the face, man. And what we love the most is violent hits. That's what gets all the replay action. Somebody gets hit hard and their bone pops out. Man, that gets replayed, YouTube billions of hits. Violence. So movies now, you have to escalate the violence to even a higher degree. I think that's something to be aware of. As I began reading the Old Testament and studying the prophets, I became aware of how dulled I'd become to how much violence is around and how I just watch it and don't even think much about it. And wondering if that's a desensitization of my spiritual heart towards God, and just trying to be more aware that violence is always a reflection of the spiritual deterioration of a nation. So those are just my thoughts. I'm not going to become a pacifist.
So no more UFC fans here. No more UFC.
How about those who watch live UFC?
See, I took a risk in sharing my heart here with you. I knew I would be abused and mocked, but that's okay. No. I'm just let the Holy Spirit bring conviction wherever He wants to bring it.
Because life is a fight.
It is a fight, yeah, and there's no doubt. There's warfare, and certainly God initiates warfare.
Yeah,
He gets no pleasure out of it. He doesn't get excited about the death count, right? Yeah, go ahead, Ferdy.
I don't even have to go watch a movie. You know it's fake. UFC, you know it's fake. No. But I go to my Facebook and see ISIS killing two Japanese journalists. And burning one Jordanian pilot right before your eyes.
Yeah.
And North Korean crossing the border, eating Chinese for their food. These are real. This is not just a football. This is not.
Yeah.
This is happening. It's before your eyes.
Yeah.
It's, you saw a mother out from history, cooking the baby as a food. We're talking about Chinese. They're filleting a human flesh being eaten right now. I mean, in our generation, violence is just everywhere.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah.
That's just my point.
Thank you, Ferdy. That was sobering.
Yeah. Even the way the bodies of the SAF commanders were treated after they died.
Exactly.
They filmed it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's chopped up the body.
So,
if you remember, and you probably don't, it was a long time ago when we were in Genesis. Mm-hmm. But the primary reason given for the destruction of the flood is because violence had increased so much on the earth. So out of all the ways God thought to characterize spiritual deterioration and sin, He used the category of violence. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And so sometimes our promotion of movies that are excessively violent, you know, gratuitously violent. I mean, obviously they're war, killing. I mean, that's a reality. So I'm not opposed to depicting it. But it's the glorification of it. go into new ways and to show it even gorier and more. So anyway, thank you. That's a good thought. God's answer to Habakkuk's first question is Babylon is coming to execute judgment against unrighteousness. So here's God's answer. Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. What an astonishing thought this is. And that's why God says, I'm going to tell you something, and if it wasn't me that was telling you, you wouldn't believe it. This is utterly astonishing. But what I've done is I am prospering and blessing Babylon so that financially they can increase their army. I'm bringing blessing on the nation. So there's money so they can increase their armies, so they can come and kill your people. Be utterly amazed. If it wasn't me saying it, you wouldn't believe it. I am raising up. See, raising up, there's a lot implied in that. I mean, for a nation to be raised up, there's got to be political stability. So God worked in the nation to bring about political stability. All kinds of factors involved in getting political stability. God was involved in all those factors, make the nation stable, a powerful leader, lots of money, and now the nation's in a place where that nation will be my instrument to bring destruction upon you. God is sovereign in the nations. And he raises up one and he puts down another in his time and for his purpose. That's why Paul said on the Areopagus, beforehand he appointed the times, the boundaries, and the seasons for all the nations. So why are there 7,107 islands that make up the Philippines? Because God predetermined before the history of mankind that there would be those exact islands in this exact location for his purposes. And why does one nation invade another nation? God raises him up to bring his ultimate judgment and his ultimate purpose. This is a pretty astonishing thought, isn't it? Nixon, that'll keep you up again tonight. torment. Now, so I'm bringing this up because I so appreciate the last 2 years of my Old Testament study has given me such a new appreciation for the New Testament and a new context. And I think it's helping me see clearer the importance of framing our definitions, our concepts of the love of God without leaving this, his judgments. I know we did one series, was it last year or 2 years ago, about the attributes of God we don't like. That was 2 years ago, wasn't it? What was it called, Noel? You were in charge, wasn't it? The God Nobody Wants or something? Yeah. And I mean, that's great one series, but I mean, it frames the whole good news. God's judgment and his righteousness and his holiness that he brings. So more than just one good series, it's like a context for our gospel preaching. Gilbert.
Well, I think while we were talking, Manny, with the senior pastors about praying for what's happening in Mindanao,
yeah,
I think that's a good perspective for us as we pray. It's God's will to be done in Mindanao, because there's a lot of pros and cons about what to do there, about the law that's being signed, the pros if that's signed, because there's going to be a peace, but there's a lot that doesn't want it.
Yeah.
Even Christians are divided. I was just reminding them, and again, Psalm 46 that I read, sometimes God causes destruction, and then sometimes God causes wars to end.
Sure.
But in the end, his promise is his purpose is for him to be honored.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's hard to discern what are we going to pray God destroy or God. Because in our human mind, the prayer is always, Lord, stop the war, stop the war.
Yeah.
But then we have to learn, again, for all of us, because we're in here, this is an issue in the Philippines right now. I think the best prayer we can pray for is, Lord, let your will be done, let your purpose be fulfilled in our nation.
If
whatever it is, our mind is limited, but let your purpose be.
So. Yeah. It's a great point. Yeah. I like the concept of God is the primary cause, and that there are secondary causes. And I think from a pastoral standpoint, that's probably helpful for people. So if we make statements like, God was behind the killing of the 44, right? You know, that's not going to play out too well. So for example here, the secondary cause is Babylon, right? So sinful Babylon, we're going to get to Habakkuk's second prayer in response to that, brings to the question of that Babylon is still held accountable for their sinful actions. So God raises up Babylon. That's a secondary cause. So who is behind the killing? Obviously, there's demonic forces. The devil. And we see that in the book of Job, don't we? The secondary cause. God doesn't bring the destruction. It's actually the devil that does. But ultimately, the will of God, God is ultimately sovereign. And he uses those secondary means to accomplish his ultimate purposes. So I think that there's still evil men and demonic forces that have to be resisted in this world. But in the midst of what happens, God's ultimate purpose will be accomplished. Which leads us to number four, Habakkuk's second question. And of course, I mean, the first question that comes to your mind, Lord, why would you allow a wicked nation to destroy your people? How can this be? So God, how could you allow those 44 people to be killed? How can you allow that? God's answer to the question is he will also judge Babylon. And so he comes on strong then, Habakkuk chapter 2, because you have looted many nations, all the remainder of the peoples will loot you. Now, the whole passage of starting in verse 6, go through 22, is a literary genre called a taunt or a mocking song, which is really powerful. So God speaks to Babylon in a taunt. It's a mocking song. You know what a taunt or a mocking song? I'm thinking probably the best example is Queen's We Will Rock You. That's a taunting song, right? That's the passage. It's God's up there saying to Babylon, we will rock you. Yeah. There we go. That's in the Bible. Isn't that? God's just mocking Babylon. Go ahead. Shoot your best shot. I've used you to this, but I'm coming. And I'm going to mock you. So it's just a mocking, taunting song. Right there. There's five woes. Just God just beating them down. Which is a beautiful picture of ultimate sovereignty. That somehow in the midst of all the events in life, God is behind it. If you're a compatibilist, of course. If you're an open theist. There's actually a case in one of their books where, from a pastoral standpoint, so this one particular girl, as a young girl, she has a powerful encounter with Christ, and she wants to serve Jesus in the mission field. And so she prays and she asks God to give her a husband who has a call to the missions. She goes to Bible school. She meets this man there who's got a passion for the same nation she has. They get married. They finish their training. They go to this nation. And the husband turns away from Christ and abandons her. It's a terrible encounter situation. She comes back. So she's talking with the guy, the author who's writing. Now, an open theist, hear how he counseled her. Whoops. Here's the counsel. God's sorry. He didn't know that was going to happen. God's sorry. He's sorry that that happened. He didn't know that was coming. He didn't see that coming. Yeah. That wasn't his plan. This guy made a choice, and God didn't see it coming. And so God feels sorry for you. He feels bad. Sorry that this happened. I'm not sure that's going to make me feel very good. Anyway. You know, some ideas sound good until you work them out to their pastoral implication. And then they don't sound so good. It doesn't sound like a good pastoral advice. But, you know, that's how we advance. That's how we pastor people with this. Is one of the books is entitled The God Who Risks. He took a chance. It didn't work out. Sorry. Sorry.
And that's one girl with one marriage. I mean, what do you do with, like, the Holocaust or the massacre in Cambodia?
Yeah,
or
I don't know.
China?
I don't know.
Sorry, I took a risk. I thought Hitler was going to be a good guy.
I don't know, Joseph. Of course, if you'd been here in the first session, you could have asked that question. We could have talked about it. The Lord didn't know. I knew you guys would like this too much, that taunting song. That's how Filipinos express love, though, isn't it? With taunting songs and mocking. Intercanonical themes in the book of Habakkuk is kingdom. Number one, kingdom. While we await the historic consummation of the kingdom of God, we are to live by faith. The powerful theme of Habakkuk is the triumph of faith. Habakkuk begins in perplexity and progresses to certainty. He learns that despite his circumstances, he's got to continue to believe that the judge of the whole earth will do right. The righteous will live by faith. That's the message he gets in the midst of, I don't understand. Yeah. One thing you do know, you got to live by faith.
There
you go. You don't have all the answers, but one thing that's clear, live by faith. Live by faith. Habakkuk builds his faith by reflecting on God's faithfulness in history. I think that's a great thought. See, he says, O Lord, I've heard the report of you and your work. O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So he builds up his faith. By remembering the faithfulness of God in the past. Lord, you did this, you did that, you did this. I don't understand what's happening to me in my life right now, but I know you're faithful. I'm going to live by faith as I meditate on what you've done in the past. My faith is strengthened to continue to walk by faith, even when I don't understand the answers to why this is happening. Number three, last thought, Habakkuk demonstrates the triumph of faith in his own spiritual journey. He concludes the book with a victory song describing the appearance of the divine warrior. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold and there be no herds in the stall, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's, and he makes me tread on the high places. We have an interlude now in our story, and we're going to deal with some of the wisdom literature here briefly. Wisdom literature is a class of biblical writings that deals with practical ethics and righteous living in a fallen world. It provides instructions for living while pondering the difficulties of life. Its goal is to supply the reader with the information to make right choices in the fear of the Lord. Wisdom literature comes in different forms, but it's usually characterized by short, pithy statements or lengthy monologues and dialogues to probe the meaning of life, the problem of good and evil, and the relationship between God and people. So the two basic categories, right? So Proverbs are mostly short, pithy statements, whereas Job and Song of Solomon are lengthy monologues or dialogues dealing with the important issues of life. Wisdom literature was an important genre in the ancient Near East, and you can make comparisons between Ecclesiastes and various different writings, or the Song of Solomon, etc. The difference, the thing that distinguishes wisdom literature in the Bible from wisdom literature in ancient Near East is that biblical wisdom literature is always framed in the fear of the Lord. That's the phrase, that's the context that goes through the wisdom literature. It's the fear of the Lord. It's not just human wisdom. It's in the context of an accountability we'll give one day to God. And so we live in the fear of the Lord. Wisdom literature can be found in various places throughout Scripture, but the term usually refers to Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. It's difficult to fit into redemption history because it doesn't advance the storyline of the Bible. So far the books we've been looking at and the ones we'll look at subsequent, they move the story along. But there's no plot in Proverbs. It doesn't advance the story along. However, wisdom literature does fit into redemption history because God's story is an all-encompassing story that touches every area of life. Wisdom literature answers the question of what it looks like specifically and practically to live in a relationship with God. All right, we already did Job, so I want to break now and come back at 11, because I need to end at 11:45 so I can get lunch before my 1 o'clock meeting. So we'll break now, come back at 11.